Hello and welcome to the Amber Spycast, the bi-weekly one-stop shop for His Dark Materials. I'm Alaric, and with these continued amazing co-hosts, we'll be diving into a rediscovery of this classic fantasy tome throughout the summer, leading up to the premiere, the new series, continuing through the rest of the written trilogy. I'm joined tonight, as always, by Joanna.
Giving you a quick summary of the chapters that we read leading up to this episode. So, the Golden Compass opens with a young girl named Lyra Belacqua and her demon Pantalaemon attempting to spy on the master at Jordan College in Oxford. While they're sneaking around the retiring room, Lyra and Pantalaemon are forced to hide in a wardrobe to keep from being discovered. From a crack in the door, Lyra sees the master come in and poisons a decanter of wine called Toke. Shortly after, Lyra's formidable uncle, Lord Asriel, enters the retiring room and pours a glass of Toke for himself. Lyra calls out from the wardrobe, alerting Lord Asriel in time to save his life. Though agitated with her, Asriel instructs Lyra to be of use and spy on the master from the wardrobe. During a strange and secret meeting about dust, Asriel convinces the scholars to fund another expedition north so he may continue his research. Lyra is fascinated by dust and begs Lord Asriel to take her with him, but he refuses, demanding she stay at Jordan College. Lyra's best friend is a boy named Roger Parslow, whose family works in the kitchen at the college. Lyra and Roger spend their days exploring the roofs and catacombs of Jordan College and along the streets of Oxford, planning adventures and getting into trouble with the local Egyptian children. There is a rumor going around that children are being stolen by a mysterious group called the Gobblers and that they are now taking children in Oxford. Soon after, Lyra realizes that the Gobblers have taken Roger and she is desperate to get him back. As she frantically searches for Roger, Lyra is called by the master to greet several guests visiting the college. Among them is a beautiful young woman named Mrs. Coulter and her demon, a sinuous golden monkey. My other co-host tonight is Travis.
Hello, everyone. How are you? That was a fantastic summary, Joanna. Thank you.
Thanks.
You must have worked really hard on that.
I did my research.
You did. This first section was big. Like, it was weighty. A lot really happened. And this book really kind of, like, gets going quickly. It's, you know, there's no waiting around, waiting for, you know, to get to know what the character's favorite colors are, things like that. I mean, we get right into it, right into that closet in your retiring room. It's really interesting. But it was funny. You know, as I was reading this, the question that kept jumping at me, and this is my second time reading it, but even you know, having gone through the book and, you know, having seen the movie a long time ago, I'm still struck by the question of, like, what is the demon? Like, I feel like it's, I don't know, it's like the essence of a person, but I don't know. What do you guys think? Talking about demons.
You know, this is my second time reading as well, and I've seen the film and I read the graphic novel. What I sort of got the gist is that it's basically a piece of your soul or even half of your soul that's outside of your body. Uh-huh. They're so linked together. They're emotionally linked. They're physically linked. Although in the first three chapters, we don't get so much about the physical link. The emotional link is certainly strong. The male and female split is also something that's really fascinating. And
then that is so neat.
It's so smart and interesting because if you could really dive deep into what that means, you know, is Pullman saying that we all are sort of, you know, bridging, you know, we're sort of leaning or balancing between the sexes, very delicately. And he's saying there's so much of both sexes in all of us that the piece of this soul that's outside of their body is the opposite sex. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting too, because it's not only a gendered thing, but it's also social status kind of thing. I mean, at, you know, the butler, any servant, their demon is a dog.
Always a
dog.
And
that's really fascinating to me. And it's right there, right in the beginning. The butler comes in, and the, you know, the people that are doing this kind of servant work, their demons are a dog. And what's so cool is this idea that once they hit a certain age, their demons take a final form, because Pantaleon in the beginning, he's all over the place. He's a moth. And then he's kind of flying around and checking things out to see what's going on in the hallway for Lyra. And then he kind of comes back and, you know, he changes form. So that's fluid. It's really interesting how fluid that is in that childhood stage. And then I'm just wondering, you know, what I'm looking forward to is seeing maybe where in the book it shows us, when does that solidify? Because that's really fascinating to me too. Mm-hmm. Because who would choose have a dog? Like, you know, that sort of submissive kind of thing as a dog for your... I wonder how much choice the human has and what their demon settles on.
Yeah, I mean, what does that say about you as a person if you've decided to settle as a servant? This is who I am. I am a servant. And yeah. I mean, is the question, are we saying like being a servant is a good thing, a bad thing, a neutral thing? It's a thing. And if it is, like, I don't know, it's just, it's crazy. Like, I feel like there's a lot, there are a lot of questions asked that so far, you know, three chapters in have not yet been answered.
Right.
But as you said, Travis, this book really kicks off. Mm-hmm. There, you know, even just, you know, the summary that we just heard, there's the meat and the bones and the intravenous structure of this trilogy is really planted so early. So much of the information that will lead us through these books is right there. And that really struck me this time. I'm like, okay, so we get Lyra, of course, the main character. We get Azrael, we get Jordan College and all the machinations of how that college works and how it exists in Oxford and how it's sort of like the NYU of Oxford, where they've just bought up property throughout Oxford and they basically own the town. All that is sort of in this first three chapters. Then we get the Egyptians, we get the townsfolk, we get Mrs. Coulter. There's so much going on and it's propulsive. And like the next chapter, chapter four, introduces almost like the major final piece of this entire trilogy.
Right.
It's amazing. Right.
And you know, you guys jumped on it in the introduction and just now, you know, the Egyptians, like that's one of the first concepts that kind of like jumps out at me that says like, this is our world, but this is not our world at the same time. You know, because I'm taking from the Egyptian thing, and I could be wrong, but I'm guessing they're the equivalent of gypsies.
That was my take as well. Yeah, they're
Romani,
seafaring gypsies. You know, is a little bit different, a little take on it, but yeah, seafaring gypsies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing I was trying to nail down, because you know, recognizing that this is clearly not the world that we live in. If it's supposed to be chronologically equivalent to where we are now, or is there a, you know, is this some earlier time? I just didn't, it felt, you know, it felt very steampunky, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, I got with all the Anbaric lights and things like that. A lot of things that sent me to the dictionary really fast. What is Anbaric? You know, I needed to know what that meant. And then once I did, I was like, oh, it's an alternate word for like electricity.
Mm-hmm. And was it the naphtha lamps?
Yeah. You know, and it just I felt like I learned a lot about our world reading this, you know?
It almost feels like it's, you know, 1800s, late 1800s, but then they use atomic energy.
Yeah.
You know, the atom, you know, the airships, I believe, are atomic, are they not?
I don't know. Have
we? Because they talk about, even in this first three chapters, they talk about the plutonium mines or something, right? Right. It's like...
Right. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. And then the photograms are like these motion pictures, almost like a stills, but with motion, because you see, we should probably jump right into Dust, right? how dust is captured in this new emulsion that Azrael has figured out. And sort of...
So are they like the newspapers in Harry Potter kind of thing?
That's what I was just thinking.
Sort of picture that, right?
Yeah.
Of course, like this predates Harry Potter, does it not?
By quite a bit, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, I'm picturing like these sepia photos that are like in motion, and it's really neat. Like, I'm just looking at this. Like, I want to see this world. Okay, do you expect to see people walking around with like steampunk goggles?
Absolutely.
Because I totally do.
And the film leaned into that. Like, the film was very steampunk.
Okay, maybe that's where I'm getting it from. Maybe that's why it's in my head, because I'm reading this, and I absolutely read this as a steampunk novel.
It's got that Victorian edge to it, without sort of too much description of what people are wearing. You know, Lyra changes into, you know, she has a dirty dress that she changed into another dress. Like, there's not really a lot of definition. Even Azrael, I think maybe they might have mentioned him wearing a coat. I think the servants were wearing like long coats, but there's not really a lot of breakdown. So it really is sort of the way that the world is described. You kind of lean into that Victorian flavor.
So, you know, jumping around a little bit, and thinking about the characters, and you know, thinking about Lyra, first of all, and that the lifestyle she's kind of living at Oxford. There are so many questions asked. It raises so many questions for me. You know, why would she live? Why would somebody put her in this life? Who are her parents, first of all, that are leaving her to live with this group of dudes at Oxford, you know? Like, that's kind of strange, without the wherewithal to kind of be to live like a high end life. I mean, they kind of dumped her in there, and she's like in the middle between the servants and the teaching staff. Who would do that?
But I love that. But she doesn't love it either. Like, she kind of resents it in a lot of ways, and she goes and she gets. I mean, she's climbing roofs and going down into catacombs, and she's running the streets, like literally running the streets, you know, like escaping and running, and nobody knows where she is as she's escaping that. And yet there's this part of her, and they say it in the book, there's this part of her that feels as though there's something that draws her, like, I belong here, that there's more to it. Like, she feels like she's in a higher level. Yeah. And I think that really shows in her relationship with Roger. Like, the way that she interacts with Roger, the way that she kind of commands him, you know, there's a social status there.
Interesting.
You know, it's not just character. Like, it's not just that she's bold, or not just that she's whatever. Like, I think there's a social kind of hierarchy there that, and she kind of commands it.
Well, Roger fully follows her. He is...
Right.
He follows her. He would follow her off a cliff. She hung the moon for him, basically. But also some of the scholars and the other people in the college, they know she's highborn. So this could be a part of it, but they don't know what to do with her. She doesn't listen. She talks back. She basically mumbles responses all the time. She couldn't be bothered with half the things that they want her to do. She basically ignores commands several times in this. You know, she's one of my favorite. I would just wrote this down. She's described as a greedy little savage.
Yes, I wrote that too.
She's just a fantastic, you know, she
love it.
And almost like self-described, even though this is like an omniscient, you know, point of view. She would totally identify as that. You know, she's tough. She's an instigator. She's a rabble rouser. She's someone who is running around Oxford, picking fights, you know, getting gangs to attack each other.
Right.
You know, changing sides left and right. I mean, the whole thing where they steal the boat, you know, was fantastic. They wanted to sink the boat. She's like looking, what was the thing that she was looking for to sink the boat that they couldn't find? The little plug in the bottom of the boat.
Right.
They thought existed, but they couldn't find it. And then this next year, she's like, we're going to sink a boat this time, or we're going to make it worse. she's a force of nature, but she's so, you know, I'm very much drawn to her, and she's pulling you into the story. And Pullman is layering on top and giving us more and more of her world. But I just love this character.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I do too. And I think that's how, that's where that force comes from. That's where that, because we're kind of seeing it, we're seeing it through her eyes, all these different things. And so, you know, it, you're like, it really does just right out of the gate. It is just this mischief. And, you know, something I also really love talking about, kind of bringing back to demons, looking at who she is and how she's this, you know, right. They say she's a coarse, greedy, savage. But Pan is very cautious. Mm-hmm. Like, I just find this really interesting. Like Pan, you know, she's like, I'm going to go do this. And he's like, don't do that. Why are you doing that? We're going to get caught. And she's like, shut up. And like, he is continually almost like her Jiminy Cricket trying to get her to calm down. And she just, you know, throws care to the wind.
He's the angel on her shoulder in a way. He's sort of her conscience, but she doesn't really listen to him ever. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of pointless for him to even chime in on half the things, because she just ignores him anyway. But he's kind of a scaredy cat. Like, you know, that's the other thing about demons is, in some ways, Pan feels like he's a little bit of her opposite, but that doesn't seem to play out with the other demons that we've met so far. Like you said, the subservient class has these dogs, and they're sort of noble servants, these, like, you know, some of the statue, I picture like hounds, you know, like mm-hmm. statuesque dogs that are sort of moving around and look very strong and important, but still servants. He's mm-hmm. sort of like, he doesn't seem like her. He's different. Maybe this is another thing about her that is different, is that mm-hmm. they're both unique in some way. Did you guys read his whole name every time, or did you just shorten it to Pan every time you read it?
I think I read
the whole thing too.
I mentally changed it to Pan every time I would come up on the word. I was like, it's Pan. Good enough.
But I wonder how much of that also has to do with, again, the fact that she's a child, and maybe how much that's reflecting these parts of her that she's still kind of dealing with and mm-hmm. discovering and trying to understand, versus when you get to be an adult, you sort of, I mean, God knows we all can still learn and grow, but you kind of feel like as an adult, you get sort of like you're like in this space, this one space.
This is who
and
I
so
am.
Then, because when you look at the adults, when you look at Lord Asriel's demon, when you look at Mrs. Coulter's demon, they're very reflective of who they are.
Yes.
So I just wonder again.
They say, you know, puberty is something that's already been mentioned in these first three chapters, and how it sort of changes, and that they may have mentioned something about the demon and the child and puberty being important, and how that sort of starts to settle someone. But how many of us are like fully formed at puberty? You know, like at what point? That's the thing about the demon. It's like, is that too soon to settle? Like, is that what is going to happen?
Yeah, because there's no way that I'm the same person that I was when I was 13.
Oh, absolutely not.
Right, and you know, the person that I was at 13 is not the person I was, you know, at 25. You mm-hmm. know, so mm-hmm. at what point, you know, does that demon turn into, you know, settling? And I have to say that if I met anyone whose demon was a golden monkey, I would instantly distrust them.
Because, oh, absolutely.
Because monkeys are the absolute worst.
Right.
He's unique. Again, Mrs. Coulter and her demon, which his name hasn't been given yet, but we eventually find out what his name is. He has a great name. Mm-hmm. He has this long golden hair. He doesn't look like every other monkey.
Right.
I sort of got a bad feeling in my stomach just reading about him and Miss Coulter and knowing that a kidnapping was about to happen, which I found to be sort of when I first read this, I didn't have children. Mm-hmm. So now I have children, and my stomach was in knots seeing how cold she was mm-hmm. and how calculated her demon was when the first kidnapping happens in the book that we mm-hmm. read about. And her demon, the monkey, takes, you know, I think was the other demon a bird at the time, and he took the bird into his hands, and it was this very trusting and loving thing. But you just know that mm-hmm. they're drawing in children that are uneducated and simple and wouldn't be missed. Like, we've read about this in other pieces of literature, you know, how the forgotten right. are the easiest to take advantage of. And mm-hmm. Mrs. Coulter's taking advantage of these children, thinking, you know, that, you know, their parents are drunks, or they're poor, or they can't read, or they have so much going on, they wouldn't miss them for a long period of time, and just think they ran away because they were poor. You're reading about her taking this child and then finding out what he goes through in this, you know, this room where she's taking down dictation that she never intends to deliver to their parents. I was really kind of upset. I was more upset this time reading that section. Did you guys have the same reaction?
I did. And not just because I have children, but, and I don't want to make this political, but the times that we're living in, let's go with this, you know, what we're seeing in the headlines today, it kind of hit hard.
Yep.
You know, it Absolutely. Really hit hard, especially the part about the letters that were never going to reach their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, just awful.
Coldly throwing them into the fire right as they're out of, you know, we learn more about her as we go and she becomes a more fully fleshed out character. But this initial impression is pretty terrible of her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's much more complex than this. And we'll get into that as we read further into the book. But wow, that was a really significant start for her.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, we're touching on Miss Coulter a little bit. I'm thinking about the other adult that really plays a large part in Lyra's life so far. Lord Asriel. Now, firstly, in my head, Lord Asriel. He said
he
Roosevelt.
He has one of the more full.
Mm-hmm.
He has. Are you guys there?
Yep.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just was thinking he has one of the right away he has this description and he's described as dark and he's described as fierce and he has this savage laughter and they use that same word to describe Lyra, savage.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really interesting. She fears him
mm-hmm.
and others not necessarily fear him, but are wary of him.
They tread lightly around him. It's
yes.
clear when he comes that people are like, you know, Lord Asriel's here, and there's sort of a Twitter, right? Even though there's this plot against him, which we learn a little bit more about, it's clear that he is someone a force to be reckoned with, someone who mm-hmm. carries a lot of clout,
mm-hmm.
is able to get his way, even when they're sort of like not feeling what he's pitching in this meeting, he still gets approved for this, this additional expedition. Jordan's going out on a limb to give him money mm-hmm. for this. You find out, it's like he has a real power with words. His presence is strong. His demon is powerful and strong and beautiful. He's a fascinating character. And I found him to be in the first scene with Lyra, he hurts her. He grabs her arm and then Pullman makes a point that she's rubbing her arm where he sort of manhandles her.
Mm-hmm.
But then mm-hmm. later he has a more tender interaction with her when they have it's references an interview and that, he basically sees her every once in a while and they have a meeting and she gets marched in to sit with him privately. Mm-hmm. And it's a little more tender. And he's like, oh, have you checked out the catacombs yet? And he's like, oh, have you been on the roof? And she's like, no. And he's like, have you been on the roof? She's like, yeah, okay. But he's also like, oh, you should check out the catacombs. So she's familiar to him as well. He recognizes, the family connection mm-hmm. as her uncle, as we're reading this. I softened a little bit on him the second time they met, even though he had hurt her in the first scene. But yeah, you're right. Dark, foreboding, strong, willful. There's so much of him that's sort of, is really powerful in these first two chapters.
I read him hurting her, and again, not condoning physical violence at all. But I read it as his attempt to protect her just became so intense that he ended up grabbing her and hurting her. It's obvious to me that he cares about her a lot. This early on in the book, I think it's very evident that he cares about her and kind of respects her. All like those things that you're saying, how he, why don't you go in the catacombs? It'll be neat in the catacombs. And then, when he let her stay in the room to act as his spy, You know, I don't think he would have done that or let her hear all of that information about his studies if he didn't have, you know, some respect for her and intend for her to at some point, you know, accompany him on his trips. And I think what's so neat about that is that, you know, she wants that. She wants to not just go with him and be a supportive girl. You know, she wants to be him. You know, and I feel like that's what she's doing when she's going around to with those other kids, and she's, you know, convincing them to get into all the mischief that they do and all these other things. She's being Lord Azrael. That's what she thinks he is.
She's leading her own expeditions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
See, and I'm reading that totally different. I mean, I feel like this is like Stockholm syndrome. Like she is fearful of him. He exerts control and manipulates her. He knows she'll do whatever he says. Like, it's almost like when you know, you get hit at home and then you go out and you hit somebody else. Like, she, I don't always see it as her wanting to be him in a noble way. Mm-hmm. It's like when kids are bullied at home, they go and they bully out in school. And she is taking this very heavy-handed, very in control, I'm disregarding what you want, like in the biggest way she can, maybe to exert some of that control that she doesn't have with Lord Azrael. She has it over all these other kids and has it over Roger, you know, where, you know, and I don't know that he really cares for her. Just like, I'm not 100% sure, like Roger's her best friend, but she's not a really great best friend. She's bossy and she's mean and she's disregards what he thinks and, you know, allows him, you know, they just do these things. I don't know. I just read it a little different.
I can definitely see that perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of sort of layers and as you know, how we can perceive their relationship. Mm-hmm. He's certainly afraid of him. There, you know, just like it seems like everyone else walks on eggshells around him. She certainly is too, but he does trust her enough to identify her as someone who could be of value at that moment that could have been selfish. Mm-hmm. But he positions the master close to her so she can see his face and see his reaction to, you know, the spilled toke. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, to sort of lean into what you were saying, Joanna, is that he's not really thankful to her. He doesn't really appreciate that she essentially saved his life. Mm-hmm. I read that scene twice in a row, trying to mine, is he thankful to her for saving his life? Does he even see that? He doesn't seem to be appreciative at all, really. Mm-hmm. And really never thanks her. And then at the end of the scene together, he basically is like, okay, he's cleaning up his stuff and he just starts ignoring her.
Yeah. He just shuts down. Yeah. He does. He just shuts down. And, you know, I should have thrown the caveat in that he respects her as much as he can respect a person.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty clear that he has no respect for anyone else.
He lacks respect. Yeah.
For exactly. Anybody. Exactly. I mean, from the master on down, he has no real respect for anyone. People are tools to him.
Can we talk about the poisoning a little bit?
Please.
Yeah.
Okay. So the master is going to poison or tries to poison Azrael, and that's foiled by Lyra, stopping him from drinking it. And then he knocks it over and it shatters on the floor. We're led to believe that early on, the master, we're not on his side. But the master's intentions were given to him by the lithiometer. And that Azrael's research is so dangerous that it was the right thing to do. And the master believed it to be true. Because if we're to believe that the master is sort of villainous in a way, early on, he cares about Lyra. He's scared for her. He wants to protect her. So now we have another character that's sort of, how are we supposed to take them? Are they someone who is looking out for Lyra's best interests? Or is there a selfish side to this? Did you have a take on that?
My question probably isn't directly connected to most of those, which were great questions. But I wondered, has he done this before? Mm. You know, has he poisoned or killed other people who have come through before? Because it's not the kind of thing that you just do, you know? And poison isn't right. The kind of thing you just have. Unless that's something like a tool in your toolkit. So is that a way of life at Oxford?
It could be a way of life in this world. One would assume, although it's not you know written on the page yet, mm-hmm. is that the magisterium and the church, I wouldn't put it above them to be doing this in order to consolidate power. You know, it seems like there's been an ebb and a flow to how power is reached in this world. Mm-hmm. And the magisterium has worked very hard to get where they are now, and they're not going to lose that power. Mm-hmm. They could be somewhat vicious. It's possible.
Yeah. And again, not to have derailed your other points, which I think were important. You know, I wonder though, if he did that, you know, indeed to protect Lyra, what was the next step? Mm-hmm. You know, okay, I've got rid of Lord Asriel. Now what do I do with her? You know, what do we just keep her here?
She said it was inevitable that she was going to be drawn into this, even with Asriel's death. Mm-hmm. So he may have just been delaying the inevitable. Yeah. So taking that kind of step or taking that chance just to delay is pretty significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the photograms that we see. Mm-hmm. And the descriptions of dust. I'm still in these three chapters. If we're going to stick with these three chapters, which we are, I'm not super clear on what dust is or what mm-hmm. it is doing right. in that photogram. It is bathing the adult in that pictogram and the young child who is a complete child. They refer to him as an entire child, not a quote unquote severed child, which causes a long pause and gasp in the room. Like it never should have been said out loud.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is not being bathed in dust. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's right. I think that's right. I think when they're looking at the first picture, what they think they see are like the northern lights.
Right.
Right. And then when they use that second emulsion, the complete child is not, but what we're supposed to understand as dust, whatever that is at this point, is coming down. Because they ask, they say, well, is that coming out of their hand or is it coming down? And they say that it's coming down.
Coming down, right. Mm-hmm. And the child is somehow protected from it or is not being affected by it. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what we're led to believe early on in this story.
I mean, my sci-fi nerd senses go off when I read that. I'm like, subatomic particles. there's some kind of subatomic particle happening, you know, bathing mm-hmm. these people, coming out of these, some kind of portal. I don't know what's happening, but that's how I read it. You know?
And then we see the city in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
There is some historical precedent for this. In Hastings, UK, there has been Hastings has been seen in the sky because of they believe pollutants. You can see it, and it's not close. I believe I could sort of come back with a distance, but it's further than you would think. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, and everybody should Google this because it's fascinating. There's even video of it in Yoyang, China. Multiple times, an entire city has been visible in the sky, which has people running in the streets thinking it's another dimension.
That's super neat.
Super, super neat. Please look that up, everybody.
Wow.
Yeah. So historic materials, historical record.
Wow. Now all I need is a demon.
That's right.
That would be fantastic.
Okay. So if you had a demon, what would it be?
Oh, goodness gracious.
A settled demon, like our current demon?
Yeah. Okay. What would your current demon be?
I don't know. That's like asking me what my Patronus would be.
it really is. Yeah.
Let's see. I think it would be a guinea pig. Like, I feel like
explain.
A guinea pig kind of like sitting on my shoulder, like whispering in my ear would be kind of cool. You know, like I don't need like an eagle or something. I just want something that's like kind of cool, kind of relaxed, and that has no problem nibbling on some lettuce and carrots. Because I certainly do.
Joanna, how about you?
I mean, I keep envisioning like a bobcat or some kind of animal, like some kind of feline, whether it's a bobcat or whether it's some kind of a panther. Or I mean, I always wanted to be Chitara when I was little. Ooh, so yeah. from Thundercats, because I thought she was amazing. And yes, so cats for me, I love it because cats are like, you know, they can be really loving and friendly. It's on their terms. When they don't want you to come around, they let you know. So I kind of like the idea of having a feline, pretty big one.
I'm gonna go off the reservation here, and I'm gonna say a lemur.
Nice.
We're very closely related to them, and I just think they're terrific. And they got some crazy eyeballs too. I think that could that could intimidate people, and I have crazy eyeballs. So yeah.
Got a King Julian situation going on.
A little bit of King Julian vibe, yeah.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, maybe different accent, maybe the same accent, who knows?
If it sounded like Sacha Baron Cohen, that would be the best thing in the world. Oh, man. I think this conversation, this little conversation right now just said everything you need to know about the three of us.
That's right.
That's absolutely right.
If anyone wants to do some fan art after this first episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Our demons, please. Yeah, for our profile pictures.
Awesome.
You know, we haven't touched on the gobbler. We talked on the gobblers a little bit, but sort of the mystical nature of the gobblers and how the rumors of the gobblers have spread. We get some firsthand accounts of a child being kidnapped. And it, you know, the gobblers come to Oxford, mm-hmm. and Lyra finds out that one of the Egyptian children was stolen. And the difference here is that the Egyptians are fiercely loyal and their parents are very attached to their children, mm-hmm. and their children are very important to them and are protected in the community. Mm-hmm. This seems to be an important point, that the gobblers stepped over a line and took a child that was important. And this is when the wheels start to turn for people trying to figure out who they are. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, I think, not to get political, but just that idea that anyone that we want to define or put as an other, mm-hmm. you know, we can then say, well, they're not good. They don't love their children. Mm-hmm. They don't do these things. They don't do this thing. And then it's sort of in whatever way can justify something that's being done to them. And because I think what you said too, because they weren't educated, maybe they didn't have the resources or the education to be able to really advocate or speak up to somebody, you know, in other cities. But in this city, in Oxford, with the Egyptians, they are forced to be reckoned with. They are their wits are about them. They are very astute. They're very, again, fiercely loyal, extremely loving. I mean, they are family oriented. And I think you're right. I think it tipped the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it tipped the scale for Lyra, because then she realizes, wait a second, I haven't seen Roger.
That's right. So Billy Costa goes missing. That's right. And then she realizes where, because he was cleaning the floor, right? It was like one of the few times she'd gone out without him, because yep. he was busy. And then she hadn't seen him in a while. And then sure enough, that neither had anyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in all senses of the term, the gobblers didn't know who they were messing with when they took the Costa boy. And I think that says a lot about the world that they live in, right? Like mm-hmm. the Egyptians are alien to the gobblers, and you know, so they've othered these people. Mm-hmm. They haven't taken the time to learn about their culture in order to do this the right way. And are they not worth learning about to them? And I put that again in air quotes because, you know, clearly everyone has worth. And so I wonder, is that what we're looking at here? Are they trying to tell us that these people, you know, were beneath the gobblers, or were they were seen that way? I mean, certainly if they had the mm-hmm. same social levels as you know, people have put the Romani in our world, certainly people saw them as below, you know, the rest of the world. So it's interesting to me that you know, we're learning a lot about, again, it goes back to what we were talking about before, we're learning a lot about this world in these first three chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pullman does it in so many neat ways. I just think you know, it's brilliant.
It really is. It's his prose it's so beautiful, and there are passages
right.
that sort of take my breath away from time to time as I'm reading it. And I don't know if this is true, but it seems like it's just flowing onto the page. It's so natural. The descriptions mm-hmm. are so rich. And you know, the three of us right now are, for lack of a better term, we're all on the same page on this. We're all seeing and feeling very similar things. We come from different backgrounds. We're reading it a second time, but you know, I don't know either one of you personally, you know, in person, but he's able to sort of give us an experience here that we're all sort of going along with, and we're all sort of feeling the things that he's writing. And I found it to be pretty stunning. And I know as mm-hmm. the books progress, and the Amber Spyglass in particular, there's three dozen passages in the Amber Spyglass that'll just make me start crying immediately. He's an mm-hmm. incredible writer.
Gosh, there's a line in chapter two. I think it's how chapter two basically ends. But there's a line that the librarian says, it's, that's the duty of the old, to be anxious on the behalf of the young. And the duty mm-hmm. of the young is to scorn the anxiety of the old.
Ugh.
Yep. And then they sat for a while longer and they parted, for it was late and they were old and anxious.
Yep.
I love
so good.
It's great.
He is incredible.
Yeah, he
I mean, it's rich and it's powerful, and it's just, I'm giddy to keep reading it. And I you know, I can't wait to talk about chapters 4 and 5 with you guys, because it's, even though Travis got through chapter 4 already.
Yeah, I did.
brag.
And not so humble brag either. But it, no, it was, I love these first three chapters. I would say that they're among the best first three chapters of any book I've ever read. It's so economical, yet at the same time so rich.
Yeah, and you can read it and reread it and reread it. It's just like going back to a good entire book, or watching a movie over and over, and you pick up these other little things, you know, here and there all throughout. And he just has this way of writing that, I agree, the power of his words. And I think that's why we all feel the same way. He's able to tap into that. And you said that, Alaric, to tap into that emotion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's, and I think too about, you know, we're looking at how the Egyptians were just frantic and screaming. And Lyra was frantic and screaming. And when she goes to the kitchens, they're like, he's fine. Like they have, you know, and it's a clear, when we look at that world, we're looking at Jordan College and looking at the streets of Oxford. Those are, it's just night and day. Mm-hmm. And Lyra is stuck in between.
She is. She's quite literally in between worlds right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Any other things we want to touch on that we haven't spoken about? I mean, the only note that we didn't get to here for me, and we don't even have to talk about it, I'll just mention it. And we were talking about the difference between our world, our real world, the real world, mm-hmm. and this world, the burial of the masters, with the way that the demons were noted, and mm-hmm. the inscribed coin in their head, right, mm-hmm. in their skull, that was meant to connect connect the demon to the person. And when she took those coins, she was visited. Was it a vision? Was it a dream? By some ghasts, was she not? That was,
right, yeah.
I didn't remember that. And then I was sort of like, reread, and I said, did this really happen? It's not super clear, but she runs down immediately and returns the coins. So she must have been pretty surprised by that.
And she says, I'm so, so sorry.
So
I'm
sorry. So oh my sorry. God. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Never do that again. Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. It's real, yeah. Right? Was that real?
I thought it was real. I read it as real.
You know, yeah. I wondered if that gas is, you know, the ghost. I mean, if we're talking about the demon being the soul of a person or part of the soul, and if the demon, you know, dies, is this gas the physical manifestation of like this, the ghost? And, you know, she saw his ghost, and that's got to be freaky as all get out.
Absolutely.
You know, and the society's got to have like some kind of ritual about how to, what do we do with that? Do we, in death, is that when the soul is actually becomes part of the body again? You know,
they connect, whereas,
which is, yeah, would be the reverse of our world, where like the soul is separated from the body when we die. Mm-hmm. In that world, maybe the soul becomes part of the body again. It's kind of, it's super neat.
Really neat. Yeah. Any other notes, guys, before we sign off?
Only thing I wanted to talk a little bit about was the Magisterium.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so, so interested in the Magisterium and so looking forward to reading more about it. But there's a bit that stood out for me about the difference between our world and theirs. It was that John Calvin was the Pope.
Yes.
You know?
Pope, like how, Calvin.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yep.
That is absolutely crazy. And he moved the papacy to Geneva to set up the consistorial court of discipline, which is not dissimilar to the Inquisition in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just so neat. Just so neat. And it raises the question for me, what was John Calvin's demon? I wonder what his demon would have been.
What would that have been? Yeah. Something to think about for sure.
Absolutely. That was it for me.
Joanna, any additional notes that you have there?
I just love the fact that, you know, going off, thinking about the idea that the Magisterium is sort of representative of this, of the church, and looking at Philip Pullman, both this story and like the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, they both start out in a wardrobe. Like they both have this wardrobe as this kind of key piece where adventure begins. But the focus of, you know, the allegory of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe versus what, even what we see right now as what the Magisterium is starkly different. And I'm interested to see what Pullman does as he develops this, if you want to call the Magisterium as like a character, sort of like develops that, to see exactly where that plays out. I'm really interested to see how that continues to develop.
Yeah, the Magisterium is like the first piece of his quote unquote big idea for this trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
That's really that first nugget that he's giving us. He's teasing us that's part of this bigger story that we're going to be told. The larger theme of his books, the Magisterium plays the biggest part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also excited to read about that too.
Yeah. And I wonder if, you know, making Calvin the Pope is his way of merging the Catholic Church with the Protestant Church.
Protestants, yeah.
This is about religion.
So that it's all churches.
Large. Exactly.
It's just,
exactly.
Yeah. Right.
It's bundling everybody. Them all together. Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah. And maybe diminishing, trying to diminish them all in some way.
Yep.
In his small/large way.
Yep.
Right.
All right. Well, the next episode, guys, we'll be talking about chapters 4 and 5 only. Yes. 2 chapters.
Yes.
Yep. 2 okay. chapters.
I don't know what's going to happen, even though I've read it. I don't know what happens in the next 2 chapters, but I'm literally, as soon as we sign off, I'm going to go back. I'm going to start reading them.
Awesome.
Excellent. Thanks for listening, everyone. We really appreciate it. Please send us some feedback at feedback@theemberspyglass.com. And we have a website, theamberspyglass.com, which is under construction, but we're working on it. It's going to be great. Thank you, Squarespace. We're not shills, but you know, thank you anyway. And so yeah, keep an eye out for that.
All right. Thanks everybody again for listening. We really enjoyed talking at you this week.
Yeah. See you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.